Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
People should see governments like the Harper government, and people should see the, you know, the people in charge of the European Commission. Their behavior is literally in the service of the global corporate elites. Global corporations and financial corporations have so much sway with these politicians that they are not looking for policies that would help ordinary people get out of the terrible circumstances that this global recession has created. They're not even looking for policies like that, because that's not who they are serving.
That's the voice of author and economist Robin Hennell. On this week's show, we speak to Robin about how the European Commission and the Canadian government are only going to intensify this crisis with more austerity. So stay tuned.
We're very privileged. We have Dr. Robin Hennell. He's a professor of economics at American University. He has the latest book on the environment. And he's also the co-author with Michael Albert of Political Economy of Participatory Economics. He has been very active in many social movements, and most recently with the Southern Maryland Green and Green Party in the USA. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great being with you.
There are so many things we can talk about. You know, the economic crisis has seemed to have taken a back drop, you know, and all the great news that, of course, our media in North America covers. But I wonder if you could remind us of what is happening in Europe, because I think there's a lot of narratives, a lot of mythology about what happens in Greece, you know, that the economic collapse in Greece occurred because there were people retiring too early, there were people getting wages that were too high. And so I wonder if we could begin there. You know, what is missing from that story? Because it seems that economic crises happen quite periodically, but every time they happen, the blame is always placed on the workers.
Yes, I mean, this is a classic case of not only blaming the victims, but then, you know, saying the only solution to the crisis is to punish, you know, the victims. In Greece, two things happened. One was the cobbling together of the Eurozone and the European Union. This process went on for decades, and it was basically, you know, a brainchild of the sort of major financial interests in Europe. They're the ones who wanted this, and they wanted to put it together in a particular kind of way. And there were a lot of warning signals at the time that this was happening, when the Eurozone was being created. A lot of international economists know that if you don't have sort of political unity, if you tie a bunch of countries into a single currency, that problems inevitably will arise as soon as there is some sort of recession that appears. So what happened was that they pushed this program through during a good economic time, during an economic boom time. And just like when in the United States the Clinton administration ended welfare as we knew it, well, they ended welfare in the United States during an economic boom. And the real test of whether or not you can end welfare programs is not, you know, when there are more jobs available. It's what happens when there aren't jobs available. What happens when that first recession comes along? And just as we discovered in the United States, that when we ended welfare and then a recession came along, you were basically, you know, you were creating an inhumane situation, you know, for single mothers, for children, for poor people. They have been forced to pay the price of the fact that now there are no jobs and there is no welfare program. Kind of the same thing happened in the European Union. They put the Eurozone together during good times, ignoring the fact that the real test was going to be when there was some sort of economic recession, how were they going to solve problems that would inevitably arise? And here's the problem that arose. In the Eurozone, the Germans export a lot to Greece and Spain and Italy and France. and the Germans do not import nearly as much. Ordinarily, you can resolve that problem by having Greece and Italy and Spain devalue their currency relative to the German currency. But as soon as everybody is on the same currency, that became impossible. So a long-run structural problem has grown and grown and grown, and that is that Germany has a huge trade surplus with all of the so-called pig countries, Greece is being one, and those countries have a huge trade deficit with Germany. So when you look at Europe and you look at the unemployment rates, well, the unemployment rate in Spain for people who are in the younger part of the workforce, I think the years are something like for the workforce between 18 and 30, the unemployment rate in Spain is over 50% amongst all Spanish workers. You know, the unemployment rate is up close to 20%. The unemployment rate in Greece is very, very high. The unemployment rate in Italy is very, very high. The unemployment rate in Germany is not very high. But the reason for that is that Germany is basically stealing jobs because of the exchange rate and the fact that nobody can change the exchange rates. There's no way, you know, for any unemployment that comes during a global recession is essentially all going to fall on the pigs and not essentially create serious problems, nearly as serious unemployment problems in Germany. So that problem is sitting there. Now, if you have those high unemployment rates in those countries, well, then they are not just in recessionary conditions. The pigs are in a state right now and have been for two or three years where they have economic conditions as bad as the Great Depression. And when you have those economic conditions, production is down, income is down, and tax collections are down. Well, the other thing that happened was that during the boom times, for instance, in Greece, let's talk about Greece, there was a right-wing government that used the boom times to reduce taxes on the wealthy, to reduce taxes on corporations. They started running some very large government budget deficits. And it was basically the wealthy were simply paying less taxes and regular spending programs continued to spend as they had been. That created a budget deficit. When the recession hit, then all of a sudden, the people who were buying those bonds and financing that deficit, they looked and said, wow, it looks to us like maybe the Greek government is going to end up defaulting on bonds. So now you add to the fact that tax collections are now down because of the recession. Ordinary Greek workers don't have jobs, so they're not paying taxes. You add to that the fact that now the sort of bond speculators, Paul Krugman calls them the global bond vigilantes, they started insisting on a very, very high punitive interest rate to make further loans to the Greek government. And that's what landed us in the situation where, oh, now all of a sudden the European Union is saying, in order for you not to default on your debt, you're going to have to get bailout loans from us. And here's the critical point. The European Union said to get those bailout loans from the European Union, you're going to have to engage in incredible fiscal austerity. Fiscal austerity means you have to eliminate programs, cut government spending, and throw more and more people out of work. And that's the dynamic and spiral that Greece has been caught in. Ordinary people, people who were retiring, people who had every expectation they'd be able to retire and have decent pensions, they didn't create this problem. And yet, now what's happening is their pensions are being taken away, they're losing their jobs, and programs, social service programs, all the kinds of social service programs that, you know, make capitalism semi-civilized at times, are just being viciously cut. And the sad thing is, this isn't really even solving the problem. That fiscal austerity in Greece is just further depressing their economy. And what they have discovered is that every time they do that, and the expectation is they've cut government spending, the deficits are going to start to, you know, to turn around. They're going to start to get smaller deficits. Well, the deficits have gotten bigger and bigger, you know, in response to the fiscal austerity because it's had such a depressing effect on the Greek economy. Now, in the big picture, Greece is a very small economy compared to the rest of the Eurozone. But that's not true for Spain, and it's certainly not true for Italy, and it's certainly not true for France. And so what they now have is a situation where very large economies in the Eurozone, their governments are discovering that they are having a very difficult time borrowing money, the kind of money that you should be able to borrow to finance reasonable deficits. They're discovering they're being charged loan shark rates of interest to do that borrowing. And the European Union has really done very little. They have refused to help those countries borrow at reasonable interest rates. And as long as that goes on, those countries' deficits will continue to just get worse and worse. And instead of helping those countries borrow at reasonable interest rates, what the European Union, the people running the European Union, have done instead is say, oh, you have to impose more fiscal austerity on your populations. That's the only way that you are going to convince the bond buyers that you will be able to repay them, and therefore they'll be willing to loan to you. The upshot of this for the global economy is that Europe is in the process of essentially sending itself into a much worse recessionary sort of cycle. If this trend continues, the European Union, the people running the European Union, are putting countries like Greece and Spain and even a large country like Italy into a situation where their best choice will be to leave the Eurozone, to default on the debt and leave the Eurozone. As difficult as that will prove to be for those economies, the current trajectory has no end in sight. There is no way out for Greece. They can't get out of their debt crisis. They can't get out of their recessionary cycle as long as they are submitting to the kinds of policies that, you know, that are coming down from the European Commission and the European Central Bank. The United States and the Eurozone are basically the two single largest parts of the global economy in terms of production and income. And if we have a major turn for the worst in Europe, which many, many people think at this point is the most probable scenario, if we have a major turn for the worse in Europe, well, that will essentially make it very difficult for the other regions in the global economy to pull out of the recession as well.
We have been put in a situation where we're in a downward spiral. The workers, instead of, you know, seeing their common struggle, they're being pitted against each other. Let me give you an example. In London, Ontario, Caterpillar, a company that had employed over 700 people for 25 years, had been benefiting for, you know, great taxes, you know, a great place, all kinds of benefits from the government, including a bonus in 2008 when the Harper government went down and said, we are reducing the HST to help industrial production. And they gave him $5 million. Yesterday, they shut their doors down, and 700 people are out of work. Now, it's not just those 700 people, because that was a unionized plant that had reasonable wages that also contributed to the other economy. So the problem we face with is that we're presented with this scenario as if it was inevitable. And I don't think that's the case. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the kinds of policies that are being implemented under neoliberalism and by governments like the Harper, or, you know, the governments in Europe or in the States with Obama, who, instead of bailing out the people, are bailing out the bankers, are giving out gifts.
The Caterpillar situation in Ontario is a very typical example of exactly what's going wrong and why it is that give the companies, basically begging them to please keep their jobs in Ontario. That strategy doesn't work in the end. They have no loyalty, and when they can get a better deal from another country, you know, that will reduce their taxes even further, that will assure them that labor standards and health and safety in the workplace are not as regulated and as protected, or if it's a company that, you know, that has worries about, you know, about pollution emissions, if they can find another country where the government is going to even offer them a better deal, well, then they are now free to move and do that, because that was what corporate-sponsored globalization basically created, those opportunities for them. During the 1980s, 90s, and first part of this century, we engaged in what economists call capital liberalization. We made it possible for corporations to move wherever they want on the globe. We made it possible for financial investment to move wherever it wants, whenever it wants. When companies move out of relatively advanced economies where wages, working conditions, and living standards are higher to places where they can get less regulation, less taxes for corporations moving in, it creates a race to the bottom effect. They are pitting country against country for the most lenient tax rates, environmental regulations, and labor and health and safety regulations in the workplace. And they are basically looking for the lowest possible wage rates. It didn't used to be possible for them to move as easily and quickly until neoliberal globalization changed the rules about how it is that, you know, capital is permitted to move or not move. They made it impossible for governments, for people to elect governments, to pass legislation and rules that would prevent that kind of thing from happening as easily as it now happens. And in the case of the Caterpillar, you can say, oh, it's only 700 jobs. Those are sort of decent jobs, union jobs. And what any economist knows is that there were probably another 2,000 to 3,000 or 4,000 jobs that depended on selling things to that Caterpillar plant. So there really is a much bigger effect simply on the employment. And it also puts downward pressure on wages and working conditions. It makes it more difficult for unions and workers who are still in Ontario to insist on decent contracts. So it's not only a loss of jobs, it puts downward pressure, you know, on wages and on working conditions as well. What's essentially going on here is that people should see governments like the Harper government, and people should see the, you know, the people in charge of the European Commission. Their behavior is literally in the service of the global corporate elites. Global corporations and financial corporations have so much sway with these politicians that they are not looking for policies that would help ordinary people get out of the terrible circumstances that this global recession has created. They're not even looking for policies like that, because that's not who they are serving. They're not serving those interests. They are not looking to solve the problems. And that's why we aren't getting the problem solved. I mean, right now, the ruling political elites are pursuing policies that are in the very narrow interest of the 1% and the major corporations. And as long as they can get away with that, as long as they can go ahead and continue to do that and still somehow manage to get elected, then that's what's going to continue to happen, and the conditions for ordinary people are just going to continue to deteriorate in Canada, in Europe, and the United States.
In British Columbia, the number one economic objective that the government here, you know, the Liberals, which are, by all intents and purposes are very conservative, are pursuing is that of mining. And, of course, that's where our so-called prosperity is going to come from. And when you think about the way in which we live in a society that is facing disastrous consequences as a result of climate change, to promote fracking, to promote open mine pits, to promote the ongoing contamination of water, just spells disaster. And so it brings us to the notion of, you know, the breaking point of where do communities and state governments, right, local governments and state governments, the disconnect. Can you talk about this?
It's the irresponsible resource extraction global corporations are taking advantage of the global recession. Ordinary people are primarily focused and have their attention on how desperate they are for jobs. And the irresponsible, unsustainable, you know, companies, they're engaging in unsustainable resource extraction in various industries. It's in timber, it's in fossil fuels, it's natural gas fracking in the United States, it's your tar sands up in Alberta, and it's forestry in places like Indonesia. Every place where ordinary people are desperate for jobs, these companies are selling the story that, well, you have to let us go ahead and do this because that's where jobs come from. The pipeline thing here is an excellent example. The truth of the matter is that the amount of jobs that will be created by natural resource extraction industries, that is the way to create the smallest number of jobs possible. Those are highly capital-intensive production processes. And so there is a very minimal amount of job creation that comes from allowing those projects to go through. Now, it is a mistake to buy the idea we have to permit you to engage in environmentally unsustainable resource practices in order to get a few little piddling jobs. In fact, what is needed, and the only way that we're really going to pull ourselves out of this recession and get anything like the number of jobs that are needed to put us back to where we were a decade ago in the advanced economies, is we have a massive Green New Deal where what is happening is we're creating literally tens of millions of jobs for people starting to work in, you know, the development of renewable energy sources, wind, solar. There are more jobs there. There are more jobs in sort of retrofitting, you know, buildings, you know, public buildings and private buildings for energy conservation. There are massive numbers of jobs doing exactly what we need to do, you know, to transform our economy so that we don't create climate change. That's where the jobs are. And instead, you have fracking companies, you know, going to poverty-stricken areas in rural Pennsylvania where jobless rates are up to 20-25%, saying, well, let us do this incredibly dangerous thing that has all sorts of negative environmental consequences. And the end result, by the way, is to expand the use of fossil fuel rather than to expand the production of alternatives to fossil fuels. Let us do this because you're so desperate for a few jobs, that's why you should go along with it. You want jobs, you want a Green New Deal. A Green New Deal is not furthering the sort of production of resource extraction in a way that's environmentally completely destructive. With the aid of the major media that will sort of pit this as an environment versus job issue, we really have gotten to a point where the old story, if you want more environmental protection, you have to lose jobs. It's jobs versus the environment. That story is so backward and so wrong. The thing we need to do to actually protect the environment and avoid global warming is the only way to create massive numbers of jobs in the advanced economies. That's the project that the fossil fuel industry and these natural resource extraction companies, that's the project they are doing everything they can to block politically and see that it doesn't make any headway, because that's not the way they want things to go. But that's the way the rest of us need to push things, because that's the way we need things to go.
While we're talking about jobs and the lack of jobs, governments are talking about expanding the retirement age, this notion that workers should always be working, that, you know, what about leisure? What about leisure in creating a buoyant economy?
Leisure is the best thing for the environment. So anything that has us working more and taking less leisure, particularly in the economies where we do have a level of productivity and we're sufficiently advanced so that we don't need, you know, to be working 75 years. We can be working 35, 40 years and enjoying the rest of our lives in leisure. That's what we should be doing. What is the logic for increasing the age before retirement? That's not job creating. We've got people coming out of the school system that can't find jobs. Well, right now, if you force the people who have been working to work longer, there are fewer jobs for the younger generation to have. If it's having an adverse effect on our ability to give young people coming into the workforce jobs that are decent jobs, why would anybody be doing it? Well, the reason they're doing it is because it's purely budgetary. They're saying, we can't afford giving people their pensions, you know, at the age of 65. We don't want to have to start giving them their pensions until they're 68, 69, or 70. That's what they're saying. Well, why is there an inability on the part of the government to actually go ahead and give people pensions at a reasonable age? Well, the reason is because they refuse to collect taxes from the wealthy. If you eliminate corporation taxes and if you reduce taxes on the wealthy sufficiently, that's what's creating a budgetary crisis that seems to require that we all have to work longer because there's not enough money in the till to start paying our pensions on time. It's essentially contrary to the interests of, you know, finding jobs for young people, and it's completely unnecessary, and it's only the product of the fact that basically the 1% have refused to pay any taxes. That's where that is coming from.
Which also, I think, makes us question the kinds of taxation programs that we're being asked to take on. You know, the difference between a progressive kind of taxation plan that I would like you to maybe briefly outline versus the kind of flat tax, you know, that is imposed through consumer taxes like the HSD, things that everybody has to pay regardless of their wage.
You can look at any tax and you can ask, is this tax progressive, regressive, or proportional? And when people use the word flat tax, what they invariably mean is that's another name for proportional. So a tax is progressive if people in higher income brackets pay a higher percentage of their income in whatever tax we're talking about. That's a progressive tax. A regressive tax is one where the higher your income, the lower percentage of your income you pay in a tax. That's a situation where Warren Buffett pays a lower percentage of his income in taxes than somebody who's earning $10,000 a year. And a proportional tax, a.k.a. flat tax, is everybody pays exactly the same percentage of their income. The question you have to ask is it true that wealthier people deserve as much of their income as poor people do? If you think that pre-tax income distribution is totally fair, then a proportional tax seems to be the fair tax. But in fact, there's every reason to believe that more of high income is unearned and undeserved, and lower income people, on average, deserve every penny they get. If that's what you think is actually the reality in the world, then a fair tax would be a progressive tax that at least to some extent is rectifying this sort of injustice that is occurring out there in the capital markets, the labor markets that are distributing all this income in a way that isn't fair in the first place. There's a higher percentage of high-income people who are getting undeserved income and a lower percentage of low-income people who are getting undeserved income. So we want to not only raise revenues for public goods, public services, to pay people's pensions so they can retire. That's one purpose of taxes, to raise revenues. And another purpose of taxes is to make the overall economy a little more fair than it would have been otherwise. And only progressive taxes do that. A flat tax or a proportional tax leaves whatever unfairness there was in the economy in the first place exactly where it was. And a regressive tax, of course, actually aggravates the degree of income inequality. For everybody's information, sales taxes are notoriously regressive. When you move from taxing income and taxing wealth and doing it in a progressive way, when you cut back on those taxes and then you make up for the revenues by just having more sales taxes, what you're doing is you're basically making a tax system that is making what is already an unfair distribution of income that greatly favors the 1% over everybody else, you're making it even more unfair than it was in the first place. When you substitute sales taxes for income taxes, which is a common thing that happens here in the United States.
Thank you so much for being with us. That was beautifully said. My guest is Robin Hennell. He is the author of Green Economics, Confronting the Ecological Crisis, and many other fabulous books. Thank you again for being with us today.
It was great being with you, and people are starting to wake up every place, and let's just hope that that continues.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com.